So tonight, I'm going to be talking about stress and how we relate to the stress in our lives, and how our meditation practice can be an aid, I guess you could say, or it's a practice that helps us in the way that we address stress in our lives. And we're going to be exploring this kind of habitual stress that we face in our lives, rather than like traumatic stress, just to keep that in mind. And I don't know if you've read the book Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It's a book a friend gave me. Actually, when I taught the mindfulness-based stress reduction course for the very first time with friends and family, because I didn't want to hurt anybody, so I thought I'll just do it with friends and family, and if they all survive, maybe I'll do it with the general public. One of the friends that took it said, "Oh, we should read this book," and she gave me a copy of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And what it's an interesting book, and the premise of it is quite simple. It prolonged stress causes a range of physical and psychological problems. And it went through kind of all the research and the mechanics of this, from depression, ulcers, colitis, heart disease, and so forth. So it's something that's in our lives, and it's something that can also affect our health tremendously. And, you know, you see the statistics in terms of people taking stress leaves from work and so on that's out there. So it can be an insidious thing in our lives. And it can also be taken for granted that, oh, this is just how it is. And there's nothing I can really do about it. And some people get to that point with just chronic stress in their lives, and they just sort of live with it, and of course develop these physical and mental afflictions. Some people, you know, just try harder to work around it. You know, get busier. I'm facing stress at work, so if I just get busier and work harder, I'll be able to handle this eventually. I think when you hit the age that many of us are at, by the looks of you in this room, you start to realize that one might not work so well. That's more of I look at my son who's 28, and you know, I see the stress. I just spent a week with him, and the stress in his life, starting a career, and he just thinks if he sort of hunkers down and works harder, that a lot of the stress will go. Make some money. That's the kind of make money, you know, and then a lot of the stress will go away. Sort of try harder, and sort of the idea of, you know, I'll work really hard, and sort of in terms of meditation, that can wait till Sunday. I really don't have time because I'm working so hard, so I'm not stressed. That any kind of meditation practice will have to wait till Sunday. And again, looking around, those of us who have long-term meditation practices realize that quite simply doesn't work. To be blunt, you see how that approach or perspective can actually cause more stress in our lives. So we can become resigned to it. As I said, that's just how things are, which we can really become then unaligned with our potential, with what's true in our hearts, because the stress is taking so much of our energy and attention. So we need to understand stress, and when we talk about that in terms of insight meditation, we're not really we're looking at it probably from a little different way than if you look at many of the stress, you know, books that are out there. I mean, if you go into the self-help section at chapters, or I don't know if people still do that, or if you Google or go to Amazon or Chapters and Google that, then you'll find many books on stress. Not too many, although there's an increasing number that will look at stress from this kind of mindfulness or meditation perspective. So it's understanding how we respond to stress. So crucial. It's understanding how we respond to stress rather than thinking we can get rid of it. And a lot of the books talk about getting rid of stress. And there's nothing wrong with organizing your life so that you have, you know, fewer stressful things. It's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, you know, I often in the MBSR course do a little exercise where I ask people to write down all the things they do in a typical day. And then I ask them to write an N if it's a nourishing activity and a D if it's a depleting activity. Depleting, you could put an S for stressful, but they can be depleting in other ways. And they could be both, right? Some have, so put an N and a D. And then just look at how you can perhaps reorganize your day so that you have a few more of the N's, the nourishing activities in your day, and perhaps a fewer of the depleting. So there's nothing wrong with doing that. And then, of course, I go on to say, and then now let's look at how we might respond differently to these circumstances or events in your day. And that's really what I'm going to talk about today. There's lots of books that talk about how to reorganize your life, but it's just how to respond differently to interrupt this process of this process that I'm going to describe that causes stress. So you can't get rid of all the stress in your lives. We've talked here about the Four Noble Truths. I don't know if people remember what the first noble truth is. The Buddha taught that the first teachings of the Buddha was the Four Noble Truths, and basically the first thing out of his mouth really was the first noble truth, and that is that dukkha or suffering or stress is unavoidable as humans. You cannot get rid of it all. It's unavoidable. And then the other noble truths really talk about what causes it, the stress or suffering, and then what we can do about it. So really, I'm talking about that in kind of a different way today, a way perhaps it's more grounded in our lives, in what happens in our lives. And I'm going to ask you perhaps to explore some of the stressful things that happen in your day and sort of what happens at that moment and how we might respond differently. There's a quote from John Kabat-Zinn about stress. Stress can be thought of as acting on different levels, on the psychological, the physiological, and the social level. And its popular usage has become an umbrella word connoting all the various pressures we feel in life. So it's that kind of sense of stress that I'm talking about without getting too academic. And then he goes on to say, it's not the potential stressor itself, but how you perceive it and how you handle it that will determine whether or not it will lead to stress. Let me read that again. That's so key. It's not the potential stressor itself, but how you perceive it and how you handle it that will determine whether or not it will lead to stress. So that's a quote from John Kabat-Zinn, who developed a mindfulness-based stress reduction. So we're beginning with this idea that stress is unavoidable. It's part of life. So that truth or that knowing is really important, and in itself can be difficult to know. I mean, in fact, you have to kind of look at your... Some people think they think it's avoidable, and they'll put in a lot of their energy to avoid it. So much energy that it's stressful. It becomes a stressful avoiding stress. We cling to this idea that we can avoid stress, and that can cause a lot of stress in our lives. I know I went through this in my workplace. I thought that I could, why can't we all just get along, and all these interpersonal difficulties and a lot of stress. And I thought, if I just kept working with this person, I could avoid the stress. And then finally, I just avoided the person, which is another way of the fight or the flight, and this is flight. But eventually, I sort of realized that there are some people that I jive with, there are other people that I don't jive with. It's just the way things are, and stress will arise when I interact with the people that I have tend to have more difficulties with. And just to be aware of that going into the dialogue. I realized that, there was one person in particular that it could become very difficult. And I was walking down, and I was at that point really, becoming aware of my body sensations as a way to tell me, what was arising. I was walking down the hall, and all of a sudden I felt this contraction in my stomach. So I just stopped, and I thought, I'm all alone. What's this, And I looked, and I was in front of the door of that person. So subconsciously, I just picked up the fact that I was walking by their office, and there was a slight stress reaction that occurred. Just that points to how our bodies can really be jumping ahead, but how our bodies can really tell us a lot about what's going on. I'm going to read you a story. This just speaks to the fact that stress is unavoidable. It's called 83 Problems. It's an old story about a man who came to see the Buddha because he had heard that the Buddha was a great teacher. And like all of us, he had some problems in his life, and he thought the Buddha might be able to help him straighten them out. He told the Buddha that he was a farmer. "I like farming," he said, "but sometimes it doesn't rain enough and my crops fail. Last year we nearly starved, and sometimes it rains too much so my yields aren't what I'd like them to be." The Buddha patiently listened to the man. "I'm married too," said the man. "She's a good wife. I love her, in fact, but sometimes she nags me too much and sometimes I get tired of it." I don't know if there's a politically correct story in today. The Buddha listened quietly. "I have kids," said the man, "good kids too, but sometimes they don't show me enough respect, and sometimes ... The man went on like this, laying out all his difficulties and worries. Finally, he wound down and waited for the Buddha to say the words that would put everything right for him. Instead, the Buddha said, "I can't help you." "What do you mean?" said the astonished man. "Everybody's got problems," said the Buddha. "In fact, we all have 83 problems, each one of us, 83 problems, and there's nothing you can do about it. If you really work hard on one of them, maybe you can fix it, but if you do, another one will just pop right in its place. For example, you're going to lose your loved ones eventually, and you're going to die someday. Now there's a problem, and there's nothing you or I or anyone else can do about it." The man became furious. "I thought you were a great teacher," he shouted. "I thought you could help me. What good is your teaching then?" The Buddha said, "Well, maybe it will help. I can help you with your 84th problem." "The 84th problem," said the man. "What's the 84th problem?" The Buddha said, that you don't want to have any problems at all. So a cute story that this talks to that. I don't know if that's the Buddha actually had that. That's from Buddhism Plain and Simple by Steve Hagen, the book. But it's a story that goes around the Dharma circles. Whether it's actually in the sutras or not, I don't know. So that's the first kind of thing that we investigate and know is that stress is unavoidable. And you really have to look at your experience to see that it arises. No matter really what you do, it arises. And that first noble truth in that, you know, is, you know, as I said when we did the, just that, if that's all you ever get out of all the teachings, just that one, it can be very liberating. Because you kind of go, oh, here it is, I'm human, and this is what's happening. And it can shift your perception, and you can put it into a larger, hold it in a larger view, a larger container. So that, just that. So if that's, you know, if we just stopped there, we'd have that's an insight. Okay, so stress happens. Now, what happens to us when that stress happens, right? That's what we need to look at. What happens often is, which can happen, is a fight or flight or freeze kind of scenario with a stressful event. And this, and then I'm going to talk a bit about what this does and how this can cause health issues and illness. Before I do, though, I'd like to say that fight or flight actually has enabled us to survive. So it's not something we get rid of. You know, sometimes when we talk about this, people come away going, but, you know, we're biologically programmed to do this as a species to survive, and it's true. We have this biological intelligence that's developed over many, many, many years of evolution. So there's some kinds of this automatic reaction can be life-saving in an emergency. So stuff that just happens, boom, you know, I think if something's going to burn you, your hand or something, and you pull it away very quickly, that can happen before you kind of go through the thought, you know, should I move this hand or should I, it's a reaction. So it's an alarm reaction that happens. And it's really the alarm reaction in many stressful situations is your body getting ready for aggressive or defensive action. There's some kind of action that's going to occur. There's a whole physiological, the anatomic nervous system is involved, all kinds of pituitary and adrenal glands secrete all kinds of hormones and so forth into your blood, gives you more energy. So the sympathetic branch of the anatomic nervous system is a big part of this fight or flight, and that's triggered. Your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, your digestion stops. If you, the butterflies you get in your stomach before you go public speaking is part of this this process. Because you're in a stress reaction, you're in a stress situation, your body's going, you don't need to digest your food right now. And it goes back to the point, if you're going to get eaten by a tiger, you need your all your faculties to escape. In this case, you probably, the flight probably kicks in, and digesting your food really isn't a priority right now. We can do that later, or if you get caught, the tiger will do that. But so that's that. It goes back to those kinds of base survival things, and it actually happens in the oldest part of our brain, in the limbic system. Some people call it the reptilian brain. It's kind of the most the part of the brain that's been there the longest. At least that's what the brain scientists tell me. And there's also a parasympathetic branch of the brain that acts as the brake. So it's kind of like, if you can look at the sympathetic branch, it's the accelerator. The parasympathetic branch is the brake. And this is the prefrontal cortex, which is right under your forehead, which is the last part of the brain that developed. That's kind of your decision-making, executive functions, perception-making part of the brain. So that's your brake. So you've got these kind of these two parts of the brain. One kind of kicks in the stress and fires you all up, and you know it's the hippocampus, the pituitary, adrenal glands all going, and then the parasympathetic. There's the brake or the prefrontal cortex. And funny enough, and this is just recently found out, when we meditate, what we're stimulating is the prefrontal cortex. If you've seen any of the research by Richard Davidson that he's done, there's a famous one, you know, one on the, was on the cover of Time magazine, and they had Mathieu Ricard on the front with all these who had meditated for decades, still does. And, first Richard Davidson put them on people just meditating for 8 weeks and saw, hey, this part of the brain, the functional MRI, lights up more than people that didn't go through the 8-week course. Then he thought, oh, I wonder what would happen if we grabbed some people who were meditating for, you know, decades. So they threw them on the machine, and it was like, lit up tremendously, especially the left prefrontal cortex, which is even was associated with the happiness, known as the happiness center. I thought that's interesting too, because when we meditate, we're kind of exercising this break a little bit. You can look at it that way, given that research. So what's the problem? We've got this flight or flight thing. It's part of our biology. You've all felt it, right? You've felt it kick in. Perhaps you feel it often even. But what's the problem with it? The problem is it becomes habitual. We're habitually in a flight or flight reaction, even when things aren't threatening. It's not often in today's age that we're going to get eaten by a tiger or have these physical threats to our life. We're not hunted. This part of the brain was really evolved to avoid being eaten, and it's still there. So. And what happens is it gets triggered when our social status is threatened rather than our physical existence. So that's when we tend to get that, we get the same fight or flight, the same biological process, but it tends to be when our social status or our perception, others' perception of us, isn't what we quite want it to be. That we can get this triggering of the sympathetic nervous system. And this can become chronic. It can become chronically triggered, hyper-aroused, this whole part of the system, which can cause health and illness, ill health and illness. And on top of that, we can exacerbate things with the thoughts that we then pile on to the story. Because it's a social thing now. So our perceptions of it are key, and then we can pile on more perceptions onto that initial event and proliferate it and cause more stress. So that's the other aspect that we need to understand. So these kind of automatic reactions that are being triggered due to threats to our social status and can become habitual and chronic. Can become a hyper-arousal of that part of the system, can become a permanent way of life, leading to long-term psychological dysregulation, or another word that's used is allostatic overload.
Allostatic?
Yeah, allo. A-L-L-O, static. There's also allostatic balance that we can come to when all those systems are balanced. I'm not a physiologist, but that's as much as I understand of it. So our reactions to stress become key. So when we experience stress, we can react automatically and habitually. And what awareness, being aware of what's happening moment by moment does is allow us to react in a different way. Some people call it a mindfulness-mediated response, as opposed to an automatic, unconscious reaction. So what we're doing with our meditation practice is giving ourselves a better chance of having a mindfulness-mediated or awareness-based response, as opposed to an automatic, habitual reaction. So let's keep those two terms, reaction versus response. I mean, they're just words, but they're pointing to kind of two different processes that can occur. And I say a better chance because you start meditating. In fact, I remember asking a teacher this question. I've been meditating for 10 years and I still have reactions. What's wrong? Teach me the method. I must be doing something wrong. And, you know, it's probably a question we've all asked. Or maybe we realize, well, there's going to be times when there's a trigger. But maybe we have a day or a week where it's like, boom, 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 we're triggered all the time. And it's like, I'm falling up, this meditation stuff's not working anymore. And you could either meditate more and I've got to fix this, or I'm not going to meditate, it's not working, right? So we've all gone through this and seen this kind of scenario. So it's really important to realize that there's still going to be triggers, but it's giving us a better chance of a response, of a mindfulness-mediated response. Very, very key. These things are deeply conditioned. These habitual because they're social threats. They're based on our perceptions. They're different for everybody. So what you may see as a social threat could be totally different than what I see as a social threat. They're based on our conditioning of our lives from infancy. So they're deep. It's not something that we just wipe out easily. And we have Rick Hansen, who's written a lot about the brain and meditation and stuff, has said, I'll read a quote. We evolved. It's a typo. We evolved to pay a great deal of attention to unpleasant experiences. Negativity bias overlooks good news, highlights bad news, and creates anxiety and pessimism. So we have a negativity bias, part of our biology, part of our, it's just as a species, to look for danger. My dog has this major negativity bias. If somebody comes within 30 feet of the front door, he has a fit. But he's like, he's on alert for danger. That's all he's doing. And then he's warning the rest of the pack that there could be danger. Right? And somebody with a uniform, I don't know why, but the letter carrier just sends them. So there's even, where that comes, but there's some conditioning that's created that. And we all have this, this negativity bias, this alert system. So we have to be aware of that. So, we're looking at responding rather than reacting. We're realizing that not many of the circumstances causing stress in our lives are actually life-threatening, and mostly social. Real or imagined. So social threats. I think I've noticed is more of them are imagined than actually rehearsed. Some of them are real. There are really people that will try to threaten your social status, or situations that might threaten your social status. And our sense of how others perceive us is a big part of this type of stress. And it's important here too that we're not trying to suppress what's arising when we experience stress. It's another key aspect of the mindfulness-mediated response, is it's mediated by a sense of awareness. But we're not trying to either suppress it or transcend it. We're just trying to be with it fully. Some people think, you know, if I meditate enough, that I can get rid of the stress in my life or the pain in my body. And it's not this sense of trying to suppress anything. In fact, it's in a way the opposite. It's an allowing. People that take the stress reduction program in week 3 usually point out that there's more stress in my life. This program's causing me stress. And my reply is generally, depending on the person, but my reply generally is to look at maybe you're just more aware of stress. There's less suppression of emotions going on. So we're not trying to suppress or transcend the stress in our lives. And that's suppression is one of the most common ways that we deal with stress. And we suppress workaholism is a way of avoiding facing stress in our lives. Alcohol, using alcohol or food, drugs, a variety of drugs, are all ways that we try to suppress our emotions that arise around the stress in our lives. So this is not another one of those types of approaches. So as I said, we're responding instead. So the first step in this, and I'll start talking about what this actually means, this responding versus reacting. The first step is to break free of stress reactivity through awareness. To be aware of what is happening when it is happening. So this is the whole idea of kind of breaking out of automatic pilot and being aware of what's happening as it's happening. Because we're often lost in our thoughts about what happened or what's going to happen. The idea is bringing ourselves back to the now, present moment. That's where this whole present moment is so important. And when we're doing, I don't know what you do when you do your walking meditation, but part of that is just, you know, bringing yourself back. There's different ways to do walking meditation, but one of the methods is to feel the sensation of your foot on the floor as you're walking. And when the mind wanders off to thinking about something else, you just gently but firmly bring your awareness back to the sensation of your foot on the floor. You can congratulate yourself for noticing, right? Wow, I'm okay. And then just, you know, start over. And the idea, and you can do that with the breath while you're sitting as well. Awareness of the breath, mind wanders, gently but firmly. Congratulate yourself for having noticed, gently and firmly bring it back. What you're doing there is exercising this mindfulness muscle, you might say, in this being in the present moment. Because when we're not in the present moment, we're lost in thoughts. Right? We're off somewhere else. Not what's actually happening. So this is the first step, is to be aware of what's happening while it's happening. Big first step. But that's what our meditation practice is tuning us up for. And that's why I emphasize doing it in the morning, because it's kind of like a tune-up for the day, kind of get that muscle worked. And I notice it. I mean, I think I've said this before here. If I don't do my meditation practice in the morning, I'm more reactive through the day. I've just noticed that. I should actually get an Excel spreadsheet and keep count. And then, because I've it's just anecdotal evidence, but I've noticed that so significantly in my life that, if the thought arises as I'm walking, past my meditation room, oh, maybe I won't meditate today. Now the thought that arises after that is, are you prepared for a day of reactivity and stress, right? And if the answer is, oh, sure, fine, then, and sometimes it's, well, you just don't have time, and those are the times, because I've got like an emergency or somebody needs to be driven somewhere, right? And so then I kind of, I didn't meditate this morning, and then I observe what transpires next. So I don't beat myself up if I don't meditate. So it's responding, and I'm maybe sounding repetitive here. It's mindfulness-mediated response rather than a more unconscious, habitual, automatic reaction. So reacting automatically implies a lack of choice. Right? It's just a trigger, boom. Something happens, you say something. There's a lack of choice. With the mindfulness-mediated response, we have a greater more choice to ways to respond. Therefore, we may have a more satisfactory outcome. So we're interrupting this chain of reactivity with the awareness, and it can be interrupted anywhere. Some people think, well, they have to be aware right at that moment, right when the stress arises. If you don't catch it there, you're doomed. But you can interrupt it anywhere. You can interrupt it right when the event occurs, just bringing this mindfulness-mediated response right there. Or the next thing that usually happens is a lot of thoughts about the event. You can interrupt the chain of reactivity there. Or perhaps a behavior has then occurred. The outburst of, you blank, 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 or, whatever it might be, an angry behavior, a fearful behavior, you can interrupt it there as well. So it's the mindfulness mediated part, the mindfulness wedge, I sometimes call it, can come in anywhere in that process. Or after it's all done and it can still come in. You've already behaved. The behavior's already arisen. You can still bring it to bear, and that will help you recover faster. That's what I've really noticed. This whole anatomic nervous system firing takes some time to settle. The butterflies to go away, and the heart rate to come down, and the sweaty palms, all that stuff. It takes some time, and bringing awareness to that can help you recover faster. I'm going to offer you a quote by Viktor Frankl, who's a psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor. He wrote this, and I think this summarizes so much but what I'm talking about. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Between stimulus and response, there's a space. It may be a small space, but there's a space. And in that space lies our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So if you're reacting automatically, there's no space. Stimulus response. If you're being aware of what's happening in the moment, there's a stimulus, there's a space, and then a response. And as I said, even when we get caught, even when we're triggered, there's still another space where a response can arise, even after the thoughts and the behavior arise. And I love this. I always say this. I don't know where it came from, but simply holding whatever is happening in awareness, you change what happens next. Simply by holding whatever's happening, you change what happens next. There's these choice points that arise. Now, if you want me to put this into Buddha talk, what we're really talking about is dependent origination, causing conditions, coming together to cause an event, and karma. Whatever you do, then do, has all these ripple effects out into the world. And it's that arising of the intention, and then choosing what you do next, that then affects the ripple effects, or the karma, as it's called. So that's kind of underneath what we're talking about here. You could look at it that way. So in this process, can you allow yourself to feel threatened or angry and just be with that? That's what it's pointing to, is allowing that stressful event, that whole body, full body reaction, that full body reaction to just be, to allow it, and to be with the, whatever emotion might arise from that, to feel it. And and we can develop, as I said, this capacity to respond mindfully, like we develop a muscle, and that comes through our meditation practice. It's a different way of being with what's stressful in our lives. So it's a different way of being. Rather than trying to get rid of it, suppress our emotions, get rid of it, it's a being with what's arising, what's happening in the moment. And it's not resignation either, right? Because you can be with what's arising in that moment, but the choice may be to completely change. Right? It could be very action oriented. It's not just this is happening and I'm all okay, and this is happening. There's a pause, and then there's a skillful action that can occur. It's not about inaction. So it's a new way of being with this stress in our lives. And as I said before, it doesn't mean we'll never automatically react. We're never going to feel angry or feel fearful again. It just means that you may be more of the time you may be aware of what's happening, which will reduce the arousal at that time, or you'll recover more quickly. Here's a poem by Martha Postlethwaite called Clearing. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue. Do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Instead, create a clearing in the dense forest of your life and wait there patiently until the song that is your life falls into your own cupped hands and you recognize and greet it. Only then will you know how to give yourself to this world so worth of rescue. So it's this pause, this patient pause, where we clear space. It's kind of like a timeout. It can be a very small timeout as well. And with our meditation, we actually create the neural pathways that make this pause more likely. That's been, you know, there's been the research coming out that's been looking at that. And science has even measured the length of it. There is actually this quarter second space. That's how small the space is between intention and movement. That's where the awareness is in that space, which then allows a mindful response. It's in another way to look at it is the limbic brain saying go, and the prefrontal cortex saying, overriding it, and say, wait a minute. Right? Because the limbic brain just goes. Without that, without the prefrontal cortex, we'd all be like Rocky, my dog. Right? Bark, bark, bark. He doesn't have a prefrontal cortex, right? He's just. Limbic brain, it's just react, react, react. I don't know that much about the dog's brain, but I'm surmising he doesn't have the executive functions that we have in our brain. So that's another way to look at it. And this pause, this little pause, gives you time to assess the situation more completely, with perhaps a more satisfactory outcome. You can buffer the effects of the stress reaction. Can allow a more emotionally nuanced response. A more creative response may arise in that space. So how do you do this? I'll give you some. I mean, you can Google some of these. There's things like the 3-minute breathing space. There's STOP, the acronym STOP, which is the S stands for stop. The T stands for take a breath. The O stands for observe, and the P for proceed. So you could Google STOP. The 3-minute breathing space is an interesting one, and it's one that my wife really uses in her life, and that's. It kind of think of an hourglass, and each part of the hourglass is a minute. And this is like more for heavy duty stress. You're taking kind of a break, a 3-minute pause. So the first part is you feel what the stress in your entire body. So that's the top of it. It's just kind of just tuning into what's happening in your entire body. Totally feeling the experience. So not suppressing it, totally allowing and feeling it. Then the middle minute is focusing your attention on your breath. So now you're kind of bringing it into your breath. And the first one is more the whole event. The second one is the breath, and the third one is your whole body reactions. So yeah, the first one's like experience the whole event. And then the breath, and then bring it to your entire body, attention to your entire body. So that's another thing. So another method. I always look at it as the breath and the body are key in this. The body is like a early warning system for one thing. It can tell you what's coming. It can also really be an anchor, a grounding for what's going on. So you can really feel, well, I can really feel this stress reaction that's going on in my body. And the breath as well can really kind of be an anchor to anchor you in the present moment. Because the breath's happening in the present moment, right? You don't often think about the breath you just had, or, gee, I wonder what that next breath is going to be like. It's very present moment focused. So the breath is really good for an anchor to the present moment. And the body is very helpful as kind of grounding us and tuning us into the full experience. Locating an emotion in a particular part of the body can be also be very telling. So when emotion arises, you go, oh, where do I feel that in the body? That can be very helpful just to know where the different types of emotions reside in the body. So it's another whole practice. And it's all practice, and it's all hard work in a way. We're not supposed to say that, but it is in a way. We're supposed to approach it playfully with a sense of humor, but there is a certain amount of work to it, to this exercising of the mindfulness muscle. Because I think if you tell people it's all joyous and playful and humorous, which is a good approach to take to it, when it becomes hard work, they go, well, I must be doing something wrong. But there is, you know, like if you go on an exercise regime, there's some days where, you know, it's hard work. You don't want to do it, but you just kind of step up and you do it. Robert Thurman, he's a professor in the U.S. I can't remember which university, but this quote that he has, why do Buddhists practice so much? When is the performance? The performance is every day in your life, really. I mean, that's what rose when I read that. It's performance is your life. And you can actually look at those moments of reactivity as gifts, as opportunities to practice. Right? If nothing's happening, well, you're either enlightened or you're having a really good day. But eventually something's going to... And when you may bring the mindfulness mediated response to it, and things will go kind of unfold in a very balanced, equanimous way. And the next moment there might be something that's where you're triggered. Those are gifts as opposed to failures. Those are moments to really look deeply and investigate what happened. You know, what's going on. Investigation is one of the aspects of the Eightfold Noble Path. We're constantly investigating. What happened? What arose? Where did I feel that in the body? What thoughts arose around that event that exacerbated it? What believed thoughts arose? Because thoughts can arise, and you can just, you know, the brain secretes thoughts constantly, but some thoughts can arise. But what believed thoughts arose that then made it more, gave it more juice, so to speak, allowed it to proliferate. And so this is all grist for the mill, so to speak, even when it doesn't all work out our way. So I'll stop there and leave some time, 10 minutes or so, for any questions that came up or comments or how stressful events that came up in people's lives that they'd like to share and sort of what unfolded for them. And we have this little way of sharing where we go like this before we speak, and then we go like this when we're finished. Most of the time we do that. Sometimes we get into some back and forth. But
I am a person who takes care of my mother. She lives in a home, but she has dementia. And I'm part of a group of women who gather together daughters of parents who have dementia. So we've been talking about stuff last night. daughter says, and how to manage it. But what came to mind when you were speaking was when my mother's home calls, I know the number on the TV, on my phone, and my cell phone. So as soon as I see the number, I think, okay, she won't get out of bed, she refuses to bath, she needs a medication, she must be sick. I go through this whole process. By the time I pick up the phone, I'm sure my hands are swaying, my heart is racing, I'm totally frustrated. And she might say, well, we have run out of toothpaste. You know, and I have absolutely created a situation by the time I answer the phone that I am so full of anxiety. And then I can be ready to respond in a way that may not be, so if it is serious, she won't get out of bed. She's sick. I could be angry, or I could be, you know, and I was just listening and talking about that space. And strangely enough, when that phone rings, I give it no space. I give it simply, it's probably urgent, I need to deal with it, answer the phone. Bad enough that when I come home, I look, have they called? Oh my God, it must be horrible. 9 times out of 10, you know, it's just annoying. But it was just interesting to hear you say that. As I was thinking about how do I manage that, if I gave it just a little space, even before I answered the phone, how much better that could be. But I have come to practice to just answer it always the same way, with anxiety. So I appreciate that thought that let it rain maybe 3 times or 4 times, maybe I'll hang up. But, you know, just to take the space. I thought that's very helpful.
And there's there's a couple of spaces. You have the rather large space where the phone is ringing, which you pointed out. You could just, you know, bring your awareness to your body or your breath for a ring or two of the phone, which would change what comes next. But then there's the news, right? So there's a place in there for probably a smaller pause, because then you have to talk, which is a pause that's less than a phone ringing once or twice. But that's the same. That once you hear the news, to just allow the awareness of what's arising in, for you in that moment, and then respond. So we can get into reactions. Oh, it's the same thing. You probably get the same types of calls. I mean, we have the same situation with my wife's mother and the calls from the nursing home. And it's usually, like you say, she won't have a bath, or, you know, she's only speaking in Lithuanian. She won't speak to us in English, or stuff like this. So, but there's just that, you know, just so there can be a pause right in that dialogue. Yeah. Smaller one, but yeah.
Thank you for sharing that you, the physical reaction when you walk by the family door. I have the same situation at work where, you know, I stick to a sense. Can't breathe. I've been, you know, sitting in my office for the last month or so. It's as if they're sucking the air out. And so when you talk about that, indeed, that there are people that you just don't get along with, that's hard for me. That's really hard because. I try to, you know, have this idea of loving kindness is the baseline, is what should be. And but then I guess it's a balance of the suffering is there, because there, I guess that's just part of it. So you think that loving kindness could overcome that, but I guess the dukkha is there, the suffering is there. Or whatever is between my colleague and I, gets sort of closer to equanimity, and say, well, that's the way it is, and work on me. But it makes it hard to do what I do for a job, and that's frustrating. Because I'm letting this situation affect me when it doesn't affect anyone else. Lots to think about.
Beautiful. There's just a couple of things there I could comment. The Buddha did talk about loving kindness and loving all beings. And in the loving kindness meditation, you extend loving kindness to friends, acquaintances. He uses the word that gets translated as enemies. We in the West translate it as difficult, people that you're having difficulties with, but the word actually translates as enemies more directly. So bringing loving kindness to your people you have difficulties with. Having said that, you can bring love somebody without having to like everything they do. Right? People act unskillfully. You don't just say, well, because I'm extending loving kindness to you, I'm just going to be a doormat, or I'm not going to, So there's the whole. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but that can happen, right? So we still bring this sense of we don't have the same type of relationship with every person. Some people we just like being with them. They bring a smile to our faces just being with them. There's other people that don't. So, I mean, that's all the causes and conditions of all our lives and histories coming to that moment. That's what's arising. The question is so we have to just face the truth that difficult communications are going to arise. What we do is we really look at how we can relate to those. So whether we respond, react or respond, yeah. And not beating ourselves up when we react. So this person whose door triggered a reaction, they would get very personal, right? So one time, it was a personal, what I was hearing was more of a personal attack than a work-related disagreement. And what I said was, it's very interesting. Can you say more about that and perhaps show me how that would relate to what we're doing? And it's like, so it was not, so there was, that was what arose as a mindfulness mediated response in that moment was, okay, I'll listen, but I'm really curious how this, can help us move forward on the course. They were kind of dumbfounded that I wanted to hear more about basically a personal attack. And other times, of course, what arose was personal attack back, right? And really, that's what the person's looking for in that kind of engagement, is to have for another attack to come back, and then often anyway. So we're bringing this, and a lot of the stress in our lives, because it's social, comes from dealing with other people. Difficult communications. So that's the grist for the mill in terms of our practice. I've come across, I'm talking a lot here, I'm running out of time, but such an important key part of this. Sometimes it's impossible, it becomes poison. And the skillful thing to do is to try and be in separate work areas, like you move, or I've seen this, and I've seen this happen. Because it depends, where things are at. So I'm not saying that you always have to kind of survive those kinds of relationships. There's also a point where, you know, being separate is, and same with marriages, right? There's a point where sometimes it's better just to be separate. And so that's the same, I think, in work relationship as well. We bring, you know, we bring this, our mindfulness to it, but then we also realize that, you know, there's the action, the skillful action that might arise might be more dramatic, more drastic than mediating every dialogue that we have. Yeah. It's a wonderful area to explore, and really looking at how the Dharma and how really spiritual teachings, because it's not just Buddhism, but it's within all the spiritual traditions, how this comes to bear on how we live. This is what it's all about, right? Yeah. Hope that was a helpful. Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for coming. It's great to see you all here, and see you next week.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.